Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi!
Hey, Shireen.
Hi, Anna.
Hey.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous, and today we have a very exciting fellow podcaster with us today. It's Langston Kerman.
Yeah, Langston.
Yeah. Wait, what, am I not supposed to talk during
No, I'm glad you did.
Oh,
I
hell
had nothing else to say.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. We talk about his journey into stand-up comedy, being a teacher, and then his new podcast.
My mama told me. Come on, Shireen. What did your mom tell you?
My brain just had a complete meltdown, and I'm really sorry.
This is the worst intro I've ever heard.
And that's how they go, Langston. Welcome.
The editor will fix it in post, and if he doesn't,
no, then he leaves it in, or I walk. I walk at the end of the podcast. I'll leave forever.
Okay. I had a really good time.
I hope this really set the tone, so stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi.
Hi. How are you? That was great. That was a great start.
Thank you so much. This is my first podcast. Kidding. Unfortunately, I wish I had an excuse that I can't ever start these well. But today, we have an exciting guest with us. And we're just going to get right into it because I'm excited to talk to them. This is my... Again, I feel like this happens a lot with me in particular, out of the, both me or Anna, is that I'm usually the one getting to know them for the first time because I'm just a hermit. But I'm very excited today. We have Langston Kerman with us today. Woo!
Yes. Yeah, wow. We did it. Yeah.
Langston's with us. And you might know Langston from comedy. You might know him from his podcast, My Mama Told Me. He's currently on The Boys, which I'm watching, which I feel like I follow you on Instagram, but it didn't occur to me that like you were posting about it. And then I was like watching The Boys and I was like, Langston?
Yeah.
He thought he was just being supportive of the show.
I don't
just
remember.
This guy just shouting out the show he's on.
Like, this guy looks like me. Watch his show.
Well, I don't even think I mindlessly scroll. So you're like, yeah, cool. Like, tap, 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 tap. Just like everyone's post. And then you're like, what did I just look at? But
that's fair.
I like The Boys. And
me too.
I think
it's a fun one.
Have a very fun character. I like the twist of like who you really are is like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Eagle the Archer is a very sort of weird dude, and it has a lot of layers to it in a cool way. That said, I am not the crux of this season, so I don't want to give anybody the wrong impression, but it's a fun character to play. I'm glad they let me do it.
Yeah. I was just going to try to rewind a little bit and get to know you before The Boys.
Okay. All right.
Let's get to know Langston.
Boring, then.
Let's get to know Langston, the boy.
Ah, oh,
I hate myself. Okay, so let's start with where you grew up.
I'm from a place called Oak Park, Illinois, if that means anything to anybody. It's like the first suburb out on the west side of Chicago. And I was born and raised there, and my parents divorced early, so I spent a lot of time in separate households, more or less in the same area, but my mom was always in the city, and my dad was always in the suburbs, so, you know, I grew up weird. It was nice. It was a fun time.
That's right. You actually wrote and were in Southside, one of our favorite shows.
Hell yeah. Yeah, that's a fun one.
That's really fun. Yeah, we had Sutan on a while back, back when you were allowed to see each other in person, because I cornered him at the after party of the roast of Alec Baldwin. Just losing it. And I cornered him and I saw the twins and I was like just stalking them. I'm like, hi, hey, I love the show. You want to do my podcast? Yeah. And Sutan was the only one who agreed. God. What a life.
I mean, it worked.
I don't think you can get Q and K to do anything like that. But Sutan's, he's definitely down. They're all very cool people. That's great.
He's the coolest. I mean, meeting him after watching the show was I mean, he's just a humble, great person. Someone that, like, he deserves all the success in the world. So,
well, yeah, the show creator that is Sutan's brother, Bashir, who mm-hmm. also plays the officer on
officer
the show.
Goodnight.
Officer Goodnight. And
fucking kills me. Oh my God, that character is so
one
good.
Of the most brilliant moves I think that Bashir and Diallo sort of came up with was just casting this show with the real humans they are based on. Or these characters are loosely based mm-hmm, on. So mm-hmm. it really was them just being like, yeah, my brother's, Bashir was like, my brother's going to be the star and he's going to be the guy. And like, yeah, he used to be, you know, I think it was more Q that worked at a Rent-A-Center, but like that was their energy for a while and now it's not. And it's great. They're good people.
Yeah. Well, yeah. How did you get involved in it? Like, were you guys friends from way back when? Because he was very true
to,
like...
No, I don't know the motherfuckers. I just showed up and...
Perfect.
I did an interview. They liked me enough. And then I was fortunate to write on the first season and the second as well. And hopefully, we hope, the second one will get to film soon. Mm-hmm. You know, presuming that a new pandemic doesn't kick off in the middle of this one.
Oh yeah, that's, I didn't even think that was a possibility.
Oh, it's a possibility. I run through all the scenarios in my head. Third pandemic in the middle of first one. That's one that I play with all the time.
It does make me think because of everyone being like, and then this virus mutates. And I'm like, oh, this is the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah.
This is the first of many COVID seasons. That's what I keep thinking. Like there is flu seasons and this is the first of many COVID seasons. And that is
right.
That is unfortunate. But okay, let's go back to Oak Park.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, did you gravitate towards comedy, towards television? Like, were you interested in the arts or was it something you found later?
I mean, I've always been a big fan of watching things. I don't think for years I ever saw myself as a person who could potentially be a performer or any kind of like, you know, person in front of the camera in any kind of way. I think I often was attracted to people who were hugely charismatic, I think as many of us are. And I never saw myself as that. And so I was like, well, if I'm not that, if I don't have the energy of Arnez J on Comic View, I'm not going to end up being a famous comedian, which was fine in my head. But I think it took years of like starting to dig further into what comedy looked like and acting and all these other things to realize like, oh shit, this all has different energies and different sort of styles that allow people to enter into these conversations if they can hone into that well enough.
Mm-hmm.
And how did your, like, when you did kind of start showing that you'd be interested in, like, performing, how did your parents react to that?
I have the good fortune of having parents who have made wild choices mm-hmm. on their own. So I think that they, if nothing else, were supportive of me taking some risks. Like my mom is currently living in Ghana. She just moved there a few days ago.
Whoa, cool.
Wow.
And like full on was like, I'm good on America. This is a horrible, violent,
can't
upsetting
blame her.
Place.
Yeah.
Yeah. And her husband lives in Ghana. So she and my youngest sister, who is 10, up and moved. And that's what they're doing now. And so like... Wow. A person like that can't be like, hey, don't follow your dreams. You know what I mean? Right. You kind of have to just right. shut the fuck up and let me do what I'm doing.
Yeah. Nice.
So growing up, so you were in and out, like you were in Chicago and then also in the suburbs, Oak Park. So what was that like? What was the demographics of the suburbs? And then where were you in the city?
Well, so Chicago, I would say, and I say this not knowing any formal statistics, but mm-hmm. at least from personal experience,
yeah.
I think Chicago is probably the most segregated city
right.
in the U.S., certainly of like the major cities that I can think of. Like there are very hard lines of like racial divide and sort of economic divide that happen across the city in a way that like I've never seen in other places. And I've lived in some shitty other towns like Boston where like, you know, that is very, you know, racist as a city, or at least has a lot of racist elements to it as a city.
Overtly racist.
Yeah, but they at least let people live next to each other. And Chicago is a lot more like, nope, you look like this, you got to go over there kind of vibe. So I say all that to say, I had the good fortune of growing up in one of the few relatively diverse parts of what is otherwise a pretty segregated Chicago metropolitan area. So Oak Park is like, I would guess like 35 to 40% black, and then the rest is mostly white and some other, and like it's dope. It, in that way, it was like, oh, being, I get to be around a little bit of everybody and everything is sort of mixed up. And, you know, it doesn't feel like you're just isolated in one community, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I think Chicago is the setting of so many really like dramatic shows. Like Shameless is one of them that I can think of. Or like, I think it's presented as like really tough place to be. So I don't know. It's always interesting to hear people that are actually like natives from that part of the country being like, I don't know. It's one of those cities that just has like a lot of lore from an outsider's perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting is with Chicago, you could create a different lore depending on where you decide to locate that story in the city. So, you know, the fact that Southside is such a different take or such a different interpretation of what Chicago can be from Shameless.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of crossover, at least in terms of like the observations, is a pretty, I think, telling thing. And then granted, you throw in race and circumstance, and like obviously they're very different stories, but I do think that those two things existing in the exact same city are weird, if you will.
It is weird. And I did bring it up when he was on the show. It was refreshing to hear this perspective. But at the same time, they do tackle racism. But because it's a comedy, I think that's just the value of having a black man tell his story versus like Shameless being like a very white family's story, right? Like, I think that's just the value of having diversity in entertainment, because you're right. Both of those stories probably can exist in the same place, but we're only given like what we're given, you know? And then I'm, and me, an outsider, has like one view of Chicago.
Yeah. I think one of our goals was to also add variants to the Chicago that is associated with black people and brown people of a certain side of Chicago, that like we didn't want to turn this into like bang bang shoot 'em up gang shit, because that story, that narrative that exists about Chicago also isn't an honest reflection of what that world is. It's there's nuance in all of this shit. And so hopefully, you know, we're all working to create art that allows for that nuance to exist. And then, you know, in an ideal world, we're like fucking nailing it, so nobody ever has to ask any dumb questions about whether or not like you almost got shot at every day when you drive to school or whatever fuck it is.
Yeah.
So what was it like growing up as like a young black man in those two different areas?
Well, I should clarify, I'm biracial.
Oh,
so
okay.
My mom is black. My father is Jewish. He's he's an old Jew, as I call him. He loves that. It's his favorite thing.
That's his favorite thing to be called.
Yeah. So no, I think that probably adds another layer of like figuring yourself out building identity.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think a lot of us start to really form opinions about this stuff when we get older, more than we actually are forming opinions about it in the middle of the experience. And sometimes those questions feel weird because we're coming at it with like this hindsight of like, well, it was difficult. I had to figure out how to talk to this person. It's like, no, I was fine. I more or less got along with everybody. I didn't really have that many issues. There were some weird moments, but otherwise people were pretty chill.
That's good. That's what we like to hear. That makes us feel better.
But I do think being biracial and also having You kind of had like a White House and a Black House, right? Yeah. You had like two, your identity 100%. Was very clearly split. It wasn't just being biracial. It was like, I mean, I guess you bring up a good point is that in retrospect, you can kind of like, as an adult, be like, I guess this was hard for me. But as a child, you didn't really like have any qualms about that.
You didn't have the tools to even acknowledge what was going on.
I mean, I think there were moments, right? Like, I do distinctly remember one time my dad sitting me down. And again, my dad is the white person in, you know, my white household. But my dad sitting me down and sort of explaining that, like, no matter what happens in terms of my personal experience, in terms of my relationship with him, the world is always going to view me as a Black person. Mm-hmm. And I think that that probably was a very essential conversation to be having, especially coming from my dad, for him to sort of like, and you know, this doesn't sound that groundbreaking now because like that, you know, that's an argument we hear all the time on the internet. It is what it is. But I think at the time felt like a sort of like step forward in my way of understanding race and racial dynamics in America, where it's like, okay, even in my most white experience, whatever that means, with my family, with my friends, whatever, I am a Black person and I need to be aware of that. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. In fact, it absolutely shouldn't be a bad thing, but it's not something you just get to ditch because you've decided to associate yourself with a different set of people.
Mm-hmm. We're unfortunately treated how we're presented. I mean, I don't know if it's unfortunate. It's more just like we're visual creatures for the most part. So do you identify as being biracial or do you identify as being Black? Like that's the other thing. It's more like, are you comfortable kind of saying both?
Yeah, I think, you know, I see myself as a Black man who like many of the Black people in this country are made up of complex mixtures of a lot of history. Some of it through like raping and pillaging and slavery and other parts of it through, you know, Mark and Wanda consenting to press into each other and create
Mark
a weirdo.
And Wanda.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, are those your parents' names?
That's their names. I didn't pick
them. They were random ass names. Like,
Mark and Wanda. Okay.
No, I think much to your point, we are visual. We do understand each other through a very limited spectrum, right? Like we humans, we pretend as if we're like these deep evolved creatures, but we're not. We're fucking animals, right?
Yeah.
I had a former agent who owns a farm, and she one time posted a picture where a bunch of the like new chickens had been born, like the little chicks. Mm-hmm. And those chicks, they put them all in a box, and the chicks separated themselves by race. That like the brown chicks went over in one corner and the yellow chicks went over in another corner. And I like asked, like, is that like a thing? Did y'all do that? And because she was a white lady, I'm like, fuck you up to. And she was like, nah, they do that naturally. Like that's their instinct is to just go be like by the things that look like them. So I don't know that I'm ever like, you know, spending a lot of time worried about like these stresses on the way that we're supposed to identify or see each other. It's more about like just treat each other with respect. It isn't, you know.
I mean, labels are just so annoying to begin with. I'm trying to be okay with the concept of simply existing, right? Especially now. I just want to exist and be okay with that. But we'll get there one day, hopefully. But I do think you bring up a good point that we're not as philosophical or deep as we want to admit, or that we want to think we are. We're just kind of just animals, and we
And I think to some extent we've just created a lot of language and a lot of ways of articulating our animal behavior in a way that other animals can't. But that doesn't mean we're not animals. It just means like, oh, we're animals that get to write this weird animal shit down. You know what I mean?
Yeah. How did Kim and Wanda meet? Not Kim and Wanda. Wait, Mark and Wanda. Sorry, Mark, I don't know who Kim is.
My father's going to be devastated.
I don't know. I don't know why. The phrase Kim and Wanda, I feel like I knew a Kim and I knew a Wanda and they were friends. And this is like a really weird thing from my past. And or just a memory from childhood. And you said those names, Mark and Wanda, and I immediately thought of Kim and Wanda.
Sure. I've always liked to believe that but how did my Mark mom is the last Wanda to ever exist. I was
going to say, I've never met a Wanda. I've never met a Wanda.
I want to believe that my grandmother gave her that name and then they were burned from history.
I went to school with a Wanda and she had a friend named Kim.
This is devastating. And I'm gonna pretend like it didn't happen. My mom and dad met because my father, who grew up in relatively rural Ohio, sort of was the black sheep of the family and like left his otherwise pretty affluent circumstances. Like my grandfather was a doctor and owned a farm, and like they had it pretty sweet as far as like money and resources. My dad basically decided to like pursue Marxism and like take that seriously as like a real effort for his life and study and all that stuff. And then he ended up in Detroit where my mother grew up, and they met at like a basically like a socialist hangout. Whoa. And hit it off and, you know, vowed to take down capitalism and make sweet love. I hope it was sweet love. I hope they were very gentle with one another in a nice way.
Cool.
Those like sound like they were really hip. Yeah. Really.
They knew.
Hip to some certain things that we need right now, breaking down capitalist society. Let's get more into you as a person. After a quick commercial break, we'll be right back with more Langston. And we're back. Okay, let's just talk about how you found yourself in the quote-unquote industry. What did you do after high school? Like, what were your thoughts of your future?
I went to college. I thought that I was going to... I knew that I always wanted to do something in writing. I did a lot of poetry in high school. Like, I was a part of, like, our poetry club and, like, competed at this competition in Chicago called Louder Than a Bomb, where, like, basically kids do spoken word in front of their, you know, friends and family and peers and all that shit. So I thought like, oh, I'll become a poet and that will be my job.
That's what I thought too. And then you realize that that doesn't have money.
Well, it's not a job. It's not a job. It's a practice that maybe you can get a job with, right? Like you can become a professor somewhere, or you can somehow write a book that's, you know, selling enough that you can live off of it. But literally the only poets who can just live off of their poetry is like Jewel and Tupac. So that's the end of that. And so I think in the midst of that, I was always attracted to writing. I was always attracted to some kind of performance in that way. But it wasn't until sort of being, I was a member of this thing called the U Club Poetry Slam at Michigan. And after a while, I stopped wanting to read poems because it sort of felt old and stilted and not as exciting. I started instead hosting the shows. So I would talk shit in between people's poems. And then that, I think, subsequently started a little seed of what became stand-up comedy.
Nice.
Yeah. That's, I tricked myself into becoming an artist.
So you were like the funny MC, and then you were just like,
oh, this is a
thing. I can do this all the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, somebody would go up there and read some sad poem about their dad, and then I'd go up and be like, hey, wasn't his dad a shithead? All right, our next poet is also going to read a sad poem about his dad, because is.
Were your poems sad, or were your poems like... So, yeah, I think, like, I mean, I can relate to only writing poetry when I am very upset with myself or very just sad about the world.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it was less about sadness and more about reflection. I think a lot of my poetry was sort of rooted in reflection. And I think
like sometimes.
Catharsis, absolutely. Yeah. And I think a lot of times catharsis comes out in a sadder tone than we would like it, or even than we're actually feeling. That like it has a a haze over it that feels
like a melancholy kind of like element. But I bring it up only to say that comedy and getting laughs is much different than going on stage and like therapizing or catharsizing out loud, right? So was that transition into kind of appreciating making people laugh, like, did you shy away from that? Were you just like, I'm all in, like, I want to continue this like comedy route kind of thing?
I think what I found was that the most excited I felt was when there was laughter happening more than then there was like air sucked out of the room.
Right.
And I think I also discovered, and this is a little complex, but with poetry, you're kind of limited to what's on the page, right? That like, if I write a poem, I am reading the poem. There is no improvisation in the middle of it. There is no room to identify a feeling and be like, hey, y'all, I don't even feel that anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But with comedy, I can do that all the time. I can literally write an idea down and in the middle of that idea be like, hey, this is dumb. Here's why. And not be breaking any rules in terms of the structuring or the world that I've set up. I'm just reacting to things. And I loved the honesty of that. Like, comedy has an honest sort of immediate honesty in it than I think any other art form that I've personally experienced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how did you transition, like, realizing you're really good at coming in and making people laugh in between poetry sets? How did you transition that into actual stand-up?
I graduated from school without a job. Mm-hmm. I did my best to figure out, like, all right, I'm going to go. I think I was like applying for jobs in like advertising, is like, you know, in some version of creative advertising. I thought
like
I
could copywriting write, or something.
Yeah, I thought I'd write like Bounty commercials and then I would satisfy whatever that itch was. And it turns out you have to be a lot more sort of like savvy and talented with technology to get jobs like that. Like, you can't just be a funny idiot. So I ended up moving back to Chicago, back in my mother's basement, and working as a assistant poetry teacher at my old high school, which felt like a list of all of the things that I never wanted to do. Like, I remember sort of like having a very serious sit down with my mother and being like, hey, I'm never coming back here. I'm not going to be one of those people who ends up back in his mother's basement. I'm better than this. I'm better than you, lady. And we're done. You and me, we're done. So I enjoyed your time. You and me, we're good, but no, I'm done. And then I had to go back and, you know, tuck my tail. And so in that, I sort of felt like, well, I tried all the things that I was told to try, and sort of like followed all the rules that they tell you to follow in education. I got good grades. I was kind to people. I, you know, did my work, whatever. I went to a good school. It didn't work. So now I'm going to try some shit that's just for me, which ended up being stand-up.
And so you started in the kind of Chicago scene.
Yeah, I used to go to a place called Doc Ryan's for an open mic in Forest Park, Illinois, every Wednesday. I think it was Wednesdays. I think that memory still counts in my head. you know, some of them start to blend together, but it was every Wednesday that was hosted by this dude who is now a politician, but at the time was the only comedian I knew. And I would go up there and bomb every week until, you know, the bombing slowly stopped.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any other comedians that you're friends with now that you came up with?
Yeah. Clark Jones,
oh,
who I love dearly, very funny comedian. He was one of the first comics I met when, you know, I first started doing comedy. Will Miles was one of the comedians I met early. Michael Joyce, who's based here now in LA. But there were a bunch of guys who, Kenny DeForest.
Okay.
A lot of cool people that sort of I met early, and I didn't stick around Chicago very long. I was only there for 9 months before I went to grad school for poetry again. Oh, I doubled down. But in that time I met a bunch of cool Chicago people, and then Megan Gailey, that's another person that I met, and she was great even back then. And now all of them are doing great. They're good people.
Where did you end up going to grad school, and explain how you came back around to poetry?
Yeah, exactly. How did you come back around to education?
Thank you so much. I went to grad school at Boston University in you guessed it, Boston. And I came back around to education because I was teaching for that year. And in my mind, I was going to work as a teacher during the day and then work comedy at night, which is essentially what I was doing for the year while I was in Chicago. And I figured if I get a master's degree, I can get a real teaching job and not just sort of this assistant's position, and then, you know, go and do both of those gigs at the same time, which I did for a number of years, but quickly got worn out because teaching's hard as fuck and kids are difficult, and managing both of those worlds is damn near impossible, despite the hours seeming like, oh, they'd be perfect. They would sync right up for each other.
Where were you a teacher?
I taught at a school called Academy of the Pacific Rim, which was basically in Hyde Park, Massachusetts, right in Boston. West side of Boston, and they specialized in basically teaching Chinese studies and incorporating Chinese learning styles to a bunch of poor Black kids. So it was nice. Oh. It was like, oh, I get to work with a demographic that I'm excited to be working with. I also I taught English. I didn't have to learn anything in Mandarin, which was very helpful. And I also got I got to chaperone a trip to China. It was great.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a perk.
Yeah, it was sweet. I got to take 10 kids to China, and everybody thought that the biggest kid was Kobe Bryant. It was beautiful. It was what a tremendous journey of having Asian people take pictures of you for no reason.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was nice.
It's like, wow. Did you enjoy teaching? I know that it wasn't maybe the first passion, but was it something that you enjoyed?
I enjoy the work of teaching. I enjoy being in the classroom with kids. I enjoy the bonds. I enjoy sort of like the experience of breaking down literature together and like getting to a good conversation with somebody who otherwise may not have wanted that conversation. I do not enjoy the real work of teaching, like the lesson planning and the strategizing and figuring out how to save kids that need your saving is a lot of the really essential work that goes into teaching. And I think very quickly I realized that like this isn't my ultimate dream, and therefore I either need to get away from this or I am shortchanging these humans who need somebody fully committed to their salvation and fixing and all that.
Right.
That makes sense. It's interesting.
First of all, I want to commend you for even being a teacher. I think teaching is incredibly hard. And
I was a monster and I cursed at kids every day.
You're the teacher that like, I have no doubt that there are students that remember you and think fondly of you. You know what I mean? Like you impact, like teachers impact kids in ways that they don't really, maybe they don't realize in the moment.
Yeah, no, I've been very lucky that a lot of my students, unfortunately, they were tracking my comedy back then, which isn't great, but since have remained sort of like connected to the things that I've been doing and have been, you know, nothing but kind and supportive and like, been like, oh shit, I can't believe you used to teach us about the bell jar. This is crazy. I'm like, yeah, man, I wish you would have read it. It was dope. Anyway. Good talking to you. What a bond.
Yeah. That's pretty
cool. Yeah,
that's cool. I feel like it also kind of gives these kids hope that it's like, I don't have to necessarily go do some traditional career. Like, just because you were teaching them, you were still able to do stand up and go a different path. And I think that's, I'd be cool if I had any teacher who did something like that. I'd be like, hell yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I had teachers. I'm thinking of two people in particular, like my photography teacher and my English teacher when I was in ninth grade. They both gave me confidence in myself when my family wasn't very supportive of anything artistic. Like he gave me confidence in my poetry. He gave me confidence in my writing. And then my photography teacher, she gave me confidence that I was able to make art. And I didn't really know I could do that. And so I have respect for good teachers. And those teachers in particular completely altered the way my brain worked as far as like having confidence in my creative abilities. And I'm still getting over imposter syndrome, sure, but I just think it's great that you took that path.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, I do think that the most important thing that a teacher can do for you is make you start to feel like you are figuring you out. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we put a lot of stock in like, you know, the test scores and sort of like the grades and a lot of other things that are a reflection of my effort in a moment more than it is a reflection of my potential, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think at the end of the day, the best thing that I found that I could do for a kid is have an honest conversation about what they think that they want to do or what they think they are in the world. And so, yeah. You know, I think I don't know that I was like the greatest teacher. In fact, I'm 100% sure I wasn't. But I do think one of the things that I'm proudest of is sort of encouraging kids to take a moment to really like see like, all right, if this shit ain't for you, which is fine, it's okay at this point. If books and reading and writing and all these other things are not your speed, what is your speed? What speed do you plan to sort of like, you know, vibrate at to make sure that you can stay floating so that you exist in the world in a healthy, effective way? And I think a lot of those conversations, I hoped, spawned something good in the people they became.
Yeah. Well, what was to kind of like transition out of this very heartfelt conversation. What was the comedy scene like in Boston compared to where you were in Chicago? Like, did you find it hard to reinvent yourself in a different city, or was it kind of easy to find your people in a way?
Find my people? No, I don't like most of Boston. I don't know that I feel deeply connected to a lot of the people there, but I do think that I had a very fortunate turn. I was 9 months into comedy when I left Chicago, and 9 months into comedy, you're mostly an open micer. And if you're not, you're like the greatest talent of all time. So like I was pretty much going and bombing on open mics every night, and nobody would really talk to me, or like I wasn't building any like heavy heartfelt relationships. Right. But then I moved to Boston, and I had a skill set that while not great, made it seem like I was much better given being the new guy in town, if that makes sense. That like 9 months of practice before you show up to your first game is going to make you look like you're a much more talented player than somebody who shows up to the first game never having practiced before. And right. I think that sped me along in Boston a little faster than other people who might have been at my exact same level, but like had been growing in that scene the entire time. So people knew them at their worst.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's what a lot of people say about like, don't start stand up in LA because you don't want some like shit agent seeing you and then like ruining your career by being like, I saw them once and they were terrible. Like it doesn't allow you to really like grow because this industry. Well, whatever. That's just an aside.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think to that point, it is LA feels like a town, for better or worse, where you are meant to be bringing finished products. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have to be absolutely finished, but you want this to be closer to a publishable rough draft than you want it to be like a, you know, the thing you scribbled down and just passed out hastily. And right. So in that way, it was like, all right, I'll go to Boston and I'll learn how to do the job better. And then when I'm ready, I'll go to New York, which is what I did. I was in New York for 4 years and like really got good, I think, at stand up then. And then when I moved to LA, it was like, okay, I know what I do well at least and how to do it. And now it's just a question of getting the right people to see it.
Yeah. Right. So after grad school and teaching, what made you commit like full time to stand up?
Pretty immediately, stand up was what I wanted to do full time, and it just was more about overcoming the cowardice in my belly to like admit that out loud. That like for a long time it was, you frame stand up as like a hobby, not because it truly is a hobby, but because it's embarrassing to tell people your dreams out loud. You know what I mean? Like yeah, after a certain age, what are you, 6? Shut the fuck up. We don't have dreams. And so I would, you know, pretend as if this was a thing that I was just doing for fun, when in fact it was the thing that I cared most about in the world.
Right.
So I think, you know, after grad school and then once I started teaching full time, I knew teaching wasn't the feeling. It didn't even come close to what the feeling of stand up was. And so it was a lot easier to be honest and just be like, all right, bro, I gotta put my best in this, because otherwise I'm trapped in something that I know for sure won't ever make me fully happy.
Yeah, I want to talk about your move to LA and all of that, but let's take one more break and then we'll be right back.
Deal.
With more. And we're back. Let's quickly talk about how you ended up in LA and then we'll get into your podcast, which is new on iHeartRadio. But quickly walk us through what landed you in SoCal.
I met a lady who lived in Baltimore at the time that I was living in New York, and she didn't want to live in New York, and I'm not moving to Baltimore because I'm better than that.
Yeah.
And so we agreed that Los Angeles was the only place that we could both be happy at the exact same time. And now we're
compromise.
Married. So yeah.
Yeah. It
worked. Tricked a lady. I tricked the lady is the answer to that question.
That was a great short story.
Conveniently, LA works for me.
Yeah, conveniently, Los Angeles is a place where I can also do business. And most people are pretty okay with sunshine and palm trees. So it worked out.
That's cool. So I remember you brought this show to us at iHeartRadio. I remember when we brought you in, and I remember them being like, oh, Langston Kerman wants to pitch a podcast. And I was like, bring him in, bitch. I remember saying that to Jack O'Brien and him being like, stop, you're in an office setting. And I remember being very excited for your show. And I don't even remember. I don't know how any of these things happened. But we were also launching Big Money Players at the same time, which is Will Ferrell's imprint within iHeart. And your show ended up with them. And it's called My Mama Told Me.
Yeah, now, with that exact punctuation exactly. When you say it. It's
My Mama.
There's like an ellipses in the middle of it. A capital in parts of the sentence you wouldn't expect capitals, but they're in there.
So tell us about your show.
It's a really cool podcast where I unpack Black conspiracy theories. Me and my special guests, which are mostly other comedy friends or people that I think are really funny. Although we do talk to a fair amount of crazy people and experts. My little sister did an episode. I'll probably get her to do more of them. But no, we just talk about conspiracy theories that we as Black people were taught or believe or have grown up hearing. And we talk about where they are possibly legit or where they're completely absurd and anything in between. And it's a lot of silly sort of banter and then a lot of making up more nonsense for mayhem and entertainment. I love it.
Right. And did you grow up with your mom telling you a lot of conspiracy theories?
I don't know that I knew them as conspiracy theories, but my mom said a lot of shit that I now know wasn't grounded in always a fact. It was just a lady talking to a kid. I was, so I'm the oldest of 5, and I'm substantially older than all of my siblings. The next in line is 10 years younger than I am. So like I had a lot of alone time with just me and my mom, and I was, and she had me at 20. So she was just running bits on me and I was just sitting there like, yep, that makes sense. And, yeah. So, you know, I think my mom has a conspiratorial energy.
Yeah.
And,
right.
I think that I have I probably have, if you asked my wife, she would say I have the same. And so I like to think that I'm somehow in control of it, but I'm probably not. I think most of what comes out of my mouth is filtered chaos.
Well, okay. Was there like one, because your mom was just talking, you didn't know there were conspiracy theories, but is there one moment in your childhood that you maybe assumed something was true and then you like you mentioned it out loud to a friend and they were just like, what are you talking about? Mm. Like, is there like a moment like that that you're like, something doesn't line up here?
I don't know if there's a, if I don't have like a quick answer to that that would make this question feel satisfying. I will say that like, I'll give you a more recent example of that, but okay. My mom has like vowed not to get the coronavirus vaccine. Like she's fully off board on the possibility of even getting the vaccine, even years later. Like she's like, nah, fuck that. Because she's like, the government experiments on us. They do things to us that they're not supposed to do. There's a history of that in this, in the country, blah, blah, blah. And she's absolutely right in a lot of ways. But then there's also like, I don't know, bro, you've been vaccinated. You don't have the mumps every year because of a vaccine that you got as a child. So it's a weird dance of you know, having a parent who comes with that energy and me being like, I hear you, but also let's get that shot, dog. Let's let's both just make sure that we don't die of this very weird virus.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel that, but I think like more, I mean, especially how you described Wanda and Mark in their like early years, like it sounds like that she still kind of has that vibe of like, you know, don't trust
anti-government.
This, don't trust these people who are trying to tell you one thing, but we can clearly see in a system that it's all lies. But now it's even more heightened because 2020 is just like next level in every aspect of like everything feels shady.
I think Black people have always felt like it was heightened. Like it was always life or death for Black people.
Yeah,
and I think it isn't until a 2020 sort of comes along that other people are like, damn, this is wild. And we're like, yeah, it's been kind of wild, but I'm glad y'all here too. I don't know.
I've been questioning authority. I don't know about you.
Yeah, authority is literally everything that is wrong with my community. So I don't know that like this feels as brand new as it probably does for some people, but I do think that this is a beautiful glimpse into a world that many of us have probably been experiencing for a while. And hopefully it will become something that pushes all of us to be questioning and challenging the status quo in any direction, because it probably should be.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think your mom should get the vaccine, but I understand why she would not want to.
Yeah, no, I get it. I don't know. What am I going to tell her? Yeah, she raised me. You in charge. So that's that.
Well, how does it feel like having, like joining everyone else in LA and having a podcast?
Well, if you say it like that, miserable.
No, I just mean like
if everyone else has one, then I'm an idiot who just joined in a few weeks ago.
There is like a rite of passage, I feel like, with getting a podcast or like being an entertainer with a podcast. I think it's a cool avenue. I like it. It's like therapy.
I love it. I think that I've had the good fortune of being able to write for some things, but even in that, you are not fully in charge of everything that goes into the script. There's people that get to go like, no, that's not funny. Yes, this is great. Mm-hmm. And I think as an actor, there are so many things that like you have literally zero control over. You're just sort of like presenting in the way that this director chose or this writer chose or this collection of producers is expecting of you. And I think that podcasting, much in the way of stand-up, which no longer exists, RIP, much in the way of stand-up, podcasting really allows for a space for it to just kind of be mine. Like the producers on my show are all wonderful people, but they don't have any major interest in telling me how to talk or how to present things. They just kind of are taking the way that I do it and trying to make it as sharp and effective as possible. And so in that way, just being in charge of all of it and feeling like, all right, if this lives, it lives by my words and by my sword. And if it dies, it dies by my sword. And hopefully people think it's funny and or problematic. I'll take both. I don't give a fuck.
I mean, I'm excited to see where it goes. I think it's a really entertaining premise, and I don't know. There are so many podcasts about the same thing. This is very unique in my mind. But before
I think
we wrap
it's
up,
funny.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
But before we completely wrap up, tell the people where to find you on the internet. Where can they follow along? The podcast, you. Plug anything you want.
Yeah, okay. You can listen to my podcast. It comes out every Tuesday. It's called My Mama Told Me. You can follow me at Langston Kerman, LangstonKerman. I don't know why that's my name. It just is what I'm stuck with. you can watch me on the new season of The Boys on Amazon Prime. And that feels like enough information for people to buy into. And if you don't like any of the stuff that I've just listed, I'm not for you. And you should just leave me alone and I'll leave you alone. And we'll just agree to be silent enemies of each other.
That is silent enemies.
That's the way to live. I like that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. You.
What a pleasure.
You just have to come back.
Yeah.
You have to cut this one short. But
once
come
I
back
start
anytime.
Selling muscle milk, I'll come back and I'll have a real different energy. I'm going to be a very different person.
Yeah. Every time you say muscle milk, you get $5
yeah.
commission. But okay, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosnia on Twitter, but
exactly.
That's my plug. That's my plug of following me. Whatever, man. Follow if you want. Nothing exciting's happening.
And until next time, trust no one. I don't know. Stay skeptical.
No one. Goddamn. You know, my daddy growing up would always tell me, trust no one and never hesitate. And it really fucked me up for a long time. But that's fine. Everything's great. All right. Thanks,
right.
Langston.
Bye.
I'm going to get that tattooed on my forehead. Okay. Bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.